What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have a Fredita!
Swangles in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior.
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault?
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macro Aggressions. I am your host, Charlie Robinson. If you're watching us on Iconic or you're listening to us wherever podcasts are served, we certainly do appreciate your support. Wouldn't happen without the support of our sponsors. Chemical Free Body is a really good one. We had Tim James on the show a couple episodes ago, and he laid out how he got involved in improving his health and how he turned that into an actual company that does amazing things. If you go to Chemical Free Body, they've got all kinds of things there, not just supplements, but they also have coaching and classes and a variety of products. Everything that they sell is certified organic. It's plant-based. It's made in the United States. It's gluten-free, GMO-free, soy-free, dairy-free. The only thing that isn't free about it is the price, but if you use the promo code MACRO, you will get a discount on your orders. Anything over $99 in the United States gets free shipping. International delivery is available as well. Tim's a great guy. We love his company. We appreciate his support. So check out Chemical Free Body and get yourself ready for battle for the second half of 2020. We're going to need it. And I'll tell you, speaking of battles, we have one. The general public versus the United States government. It's a battle. Most people don't know that they're involved in it. They don't know that they're at war against the government. But I've been writing about this for a while. And one of the things that really frustrated me was when you see some of these events that are fake to their core, and yet they're passed off as being real on the nightly news. And now, for the last, 6 weeks or so, I can't even tell you how many messages I've gotten from people that said, you need to have Monica Perez on and talk about the Boston bombing. And I was like, okay. I mean, I want to talk about the Boston bombing. And Monica's here from Propaganda Report. Hey, Monica, what's cooking? How are you?
Hi, good. The Boston Marathon bombing was the thing that pulled the scales from my eyes. Like, I didn't understand. I never believed any of the bad things they said about the government with respect to 9/11. I just didn't think that our government would do it. I knew, because I was already an anarcho-capitalist, that they could do it, that eventually it would be clear that our interests were in total conflict and they would get totally rogue and be a pathocracy. And then when I saw the Boston Marathon bombing, I realized that they had already gotten there. And then when I kind of dug into who those guys were, the Tsarnaevs, and some of the details of the case as it was unfolding, and I can tell you why I dug so far into this one of all cases, if you're interested, but this was the pivotal time. Okay, so. Yeah,
tell me, I mean, because every one of these little events it doesn't always have the same weight for every person. Like for me, building 7 in particular on 9/11, it infuriated me to the point where I couldn't go back to sleep. And so everybody's got their own scenario that they come, an event that wakes them up. So Boston bombing for you. So tell us how that worked. I mean, I understand why why this one in particular? I'm just curious.
I'm from New York and I knew people who died on 9/11 and I was a total skeptic about government. I was a libertarian and I read Hans Hermann Hoppe and I had totally given up on the idea of a self-limiting government. I loved the idea of the Constitution or certainly the Bill of Rights. I've always kind of been Articles of Confederation girl. But then I just woke up to the fact that it was hopeless. Government's never going to limit itself. And at that point, I mean, I was just like a numbers person. I was a banker. I had kids. I was trying to get back into banking eventually. And I happened to run into a radio producer and she just thought this anarcho-capitalist thing was fascinating. And she got me kind of an on-air audition and then I was on the radio after that. But just really, I was a novelty act, but only because I was an anarcho-capitalist and not for any other reason. And I would say, regularly, like, you people think that I'm a nut job. I don't believe 9/11 was an inside job. Like, I'm not in that camp. Mm-hmm. I really didn't. And the reason was I did not believe that our government would do something that bad. Mm-hmm. So then I was filling it. So I had a weekend show, which is not that much pressure. It was the show. It was the station that Rush Limbaugh was on or whoever was at the time. I forget. But like that feeling. And I would always have to kind of argue against the Fox News conservative thing and try to get people to the deeper level. So I would have to know what they were saying. And I really had to prepare myself because it was a call-in show for all of the counter narrative from the right. So they thought I was a liberal, which I was like probably arguably further right than they were. But I was, they always wanted to fight with me. And especially about war. They wanted war. And I would try to explain to them. I mean, they would say that it was the Bible Belt. I would try to explain to them that they were wrong. They were kidding themselves. They could not explain why the people they were killing were a threat to them. Mm-hmm. And so one time every once in a while, I would get to fill in during the week, which was like 10 times the listenership. It was Eric Erickson or whatever. It was just a lot of people and all the people coming home from work. And they would just call you and try to put cracks in your argument because it threatened, I think, their worldview. So it happened to be the day after the Boston Marathon bombing. So for me, I had to make sure I knew everything everybody else knew so I could answer their questions. So I just dug into it and I would read. And especially the Boston Globe was really covering it. And I would read from one day to the next, like literally the race of the carjack victim changed overnight. And I had seen the video of the guy at the convenience store who said the carjack victim was Caucasian. And then the next day he was Asian. And I was like, but they didn't even print a retraction or that's wrong. You know, I was sending them emails. I'm like, oh, you got that wrong.
Hey, so mainstream media, you got a detail wrong. You want
to, I know. Would
you
like I was to fix like, it? Oh my no, gosh, thanks. I'm such a good reporter. So I was ready to go on the air. It must've been the next day. And my producer, who is the person who discovered me, and she loved me. We're friends. We're great friends, even still. So it wasn't like she was coming down from the top and worked for the CIA. And I said, hey, man, that guy, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, his Uncle Ruslan, is in the CIA. He worked for the CIA chief of Afghanistan. That guy's daughter was his wife. Her name was Samantha Fuller Tsarnaev. Graham Fuller's this really famous CIA. You know, they were in the CIA. And she's like, you can't say that, you know? Ooh. And she wasn't telling me no. She was like, people think you're crazy. But what really was the clincher for me was that there was the CNN video of the naked man in the middle of the night. The cops had arrested some very tall guy and he was totally naked and they put him in a car and that video was out there. And I literally, it must have been the day after it happened that I was on the primetime show, I stayed up all night and just compared picture after picture of that guy's fuzzy naked chest with Tamerlan Tsarnaev's boxing pictures. And I said, that's him. They arrested him. He's dead now, but they had arrested him first. There is something going on. And we got, and she was just like, people are going to freak out on you. Like, you want to make it in this business. Don't, you know, remember, no car wrecks. Like, my boss always said, like, you can say whatever you want, but you don't want people running away screaming. She's like, people will run away screaming. So we got him on the phone, and he said, hey, like, just separate what you think from what you know and tell your story. No problem. And she wasn't afraid of it, but she was worried for me.
Yeah.
And I did it. And I had some trolls who were clearly on the inside. And this one person over and over again was Facebooking me, was calling into the show, trying to blow up my story. And what he would say to me was, I love you, I'm a big fan. And I just want to protect you from liability. You should stop saying you're positive this guy is the same, that naked guy is the same guy as the boxing guy, because you can't be sure. And I would write back like, no, I'm absolutely positive. Like, the way his pectoral muscles and like his nipple was like weirdly way on the, like, nobody looks like that. And you can tell. And I was like, all these details, you know, not realizing in retrospect, it was some guy who was telling me to shut the fuck up. And actually I should have, you know what I mean? What was I? I didn't change the world. I should have just, you know, just said, I think, you know, but I didn't. And then that's how I just kept digging in and kept digging in. Because people were pushing back on it, and I was so naive, I thought if I could only put all the dots together, I would break the case.
Yeah, and you would have broken the case, but as you know, you would have been fired. It would have gone nowhere. They would have made you out to be, you know, a crazy person or something.
Well, I think that was the thing. Like, she's like the novelty act. But I was not, I never got too crazy. I would show up, I would throw up the pictures, and I would say, look, you can see, this is why I think it's the same guy.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't throw it up on the radio, but I put it on my blog.
Yeah.
And eventually my blog got completely taken down, and all the pictures and all the videos. Like, I have the text, but WordPress purged me for just pointing out that the kid from the Pakistan school shooting had the exact same actual picture, not just like the same kid, but the same actual picture as S. Hook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that which we do not name.
I know, sorry.
Being deplatformed. I know.
People say it was, but I really got deplatformed because of that. It was very clear. They told me that was why.
That's crazy. I mean, so we watched it. We watched the Boston bombing. I remember I was in Florida at the time, and I was watching it, and I see that over the last, I don't know, 10 years or so, I watch the news very differently. My default has been switched from, like, when I was a kid, oh, you watch the nightly news. My default was, you know, they have no reason to lie to me. I don't know why they would be lying. They might not be getting it all exactly right, but there was that assumption that, like, well, ABC might report on the story one way, but NBC and CBS are still working on things too. And so everybody, you know, you're going to get the story. If you put all three of those networks together, you know, you'll probably get the story. Now, obviously that's not the case. I don't watch the news like that. I start noticing inconsistencies almost immediately and things like that. And the Boston bombing, when it happened, it wasn't like, wow, I wonder if this is some sort of, you know, drill or fake event or something like it. I wasn't wondering that. I knew immediately, just immediately, the whole thing, like, this doesn't add up. This story doesn't make sense. Now they're chasing these kids. Oh, and they kidnapped somebody, and they told this kidnapped victim that they were the ones that did it, and that they were going to drive to New York, and they were going to commit further terrorist events. And then
they had a car. When they kidnapped and carjacked, they had a car that ended up where they ended up. That was another thing. They had a green Civic, but they hijacked this car, and then some guy. Yeah. I have a theory about that. We can get to that.
Oh, yeah. Let's do it. So anyway, I wrote this. So this is, I'll read off the facts that the media claimed were true. This is from my book, The Octopus of Global Control. I did a lot of, put some bullet points in there, but this is essentially what they said. They said an explosion at the finish line of the marathon killed three civilians. 264 people were injured and treated at 27 local hospitals. 14 people required amputations as a direct result of the blast. The perpetrators of the terrorist event were two brothers, Tamerlan and Dzhokhar Tsarnaev. They made a bomb out of a pressure cooker and put it inside of a backpack. They left the backpack near the finish line of the Boston Marathon. The police and feds launched a manhunt for the two brothers that lasted 4 days. The murder of an MIT police officer sitting in his car was attributed to the brothers. The police and feds released a dark and grainy closed-circuit television footage of the shooting. The two brothers carjacked a person in a Mercedes SUV who later escaped when they stopped at a gas station. The two brothers confessed to the driver about pulling off the Boston Marathon bombing. They confessed to planning to drive to New York City to set off another bomb in Times Square. The carjacking victim left his cell phone in the car, which enabled the police to track the location of the two brothers to Waterton. A gunfight with police broke out, in which the older brother was shot several times, tackled by the police, then accidentally run over by his younger brother with the stolen SUV and dragged for 30 feet. The younger brother ran away from the police and hid in a covered dry dock boat. He wrote a confession statement at night without any lights in his own blood, in which he claimed the bombings was retaliation for U.S. wars in Muslim countries. Two police officers and an FBI agent visited a friend of the brothers in Orlando, Florida, Ibrahim Todashev. They questioned him for many hours in his apartment, but forgot to take him to the police station so that the interrogation could be filmed. During this undocumented interrogation, Todashev confessed to being involved in three murders with the brothers. In the middle of his written confession, Todashev decided to attack the FBI agent by throwing a table at him. Todashev then ran at the agent with a metal pole, not a table, and was shot three times. Todashev staggered backwards, regained his footing, came at them again with a metal pole. He was subsequently shot four more times, including one shot to the back of the head. The police changed their story from Todashev swinging a metal pole to him swinging a sword. Then they changed their story from him swinging a sword to swinging a broomstick. Then they changed their story from him swinging a broomstick to swinging a knife. The two officers left the room a short time before the killing, and the FBI agent, Aaron McFarlane, shot Todashev seven times. Aaron McFarlane had previously been the subject of two police brutality lawsuits. He had previously been the subject of four internal investigations. He had been accused of falsifying police reports, lying under oath, aggravated battery, making false arrests, violating the rights of suspects, assault with a weapon, and false imprisonment, yet he was never convicted of any charge. Aaron McFarlane took the fifth during a police corruption trial during his brief four-year career as an Oakland police officer. That is the official story of the Boston bombing, and it would be hilarious if it wasn't so damn scary. Please add to this.
Well, I just was going to try to look up. That's the kind of thing where I would wonder if Aaron McFarland is still alive. Like, he was probably a troubled guy, and they had him do this hit. It was clearly a hit, six times to the body, once to the crown of the head, if I recall correctly. Mm-hmm. And the dad, he had a ticket, a plane ticket to Russia. And he didn't go because they asked him not to go. And he told his friend he was worried. His friend was interviewed by the local news afterwards, which I actually still have that video. And he was saying, like, he was worried. And this is something I failed to mention earlier. His wife called me or contacted me, and I interviewed her. I don't know why I didn't put it on the air, but I called her in Russia. And I know she was in Russia because I was trying to call her from the radio station where I worked, and I couldn't get out because they didn't allow international calls mm-hmm. from the corporate phone. So I had a long conversation with her. She had a couple of details that seemed weird to me, but she might not have known. Like, she didn't know he was living with a woman. She said it was his roommate, but I think it was his girlfriend. And she also thought that Dzhokhar Tsarnaev was still alive. And I thought I saw a picture of him where he absolutely looked dead within 3 days of getting arrested in that boat. But the Todashev story is really a heartbreaker because that guy was totally, totally innocent. He just was acquainted with Tamerlan Snyder from the gym. He was a muscle guy mm-hmm. too. Tamerlan Snyder was a boxer. That thing about the three murders, they later could not help but say that there was no way the Tsarnaev brothers were involved in that. It was like a drug murder thing. Mm-hmm. And so there was all of that. That was really the worst, because the Tsarnaevs, Dzhokhar, I'm not worried about, but, well, Dzhokhar, I should say, I don't think for sure that he was in the CIA, although he was probably headed in that direction. But Tamerlan Tsarnaev, what I think really happened was that Tamerlan was a guy who was kind of budding CIA. He was at the Jamestown Foundation, which was a kind of offsite in the Middle East or someplace, Lebanon or whatever. And they it was like an offsite CIA training ground where he took, you know, conferences. And he was there supposedly trying to radicalize imams, pay them off with USAID money, USAID money or something like that, because his uncle, Uncle Ruslan, was that CIA guy who works with Fuller. So Russia sent a message to the US, like, get your spy out of here. So when you hear those stories that Russia, that we knew they were terrorists, it's not, I don't have evidence of that. But the only thing that makes sense is that Russia made those guys and it made them useless. And they had to get rid of them for whatever reason. And when they did that, they also served other purposes, like this martial law thing that they just brought down on Boston, which seemed like a big test case to me, where they would go from house to house with guns and see everybody just stood there. You know, I don't know if you remember Minority Report, but everybody just like stands there and lets the spiders read their eyes. You know, it's like you just freeze. And every single person did that. And I don't even think they were looking for Jahar Tsarnaev, or they would have found him. I think they were not looking for him on purpose so that they could go into every single house and see how it worked out. And so that's what I think it was. I think it was a hit on those guys and then this other social experiment. But at the time, like, I didn't even realize the whole fakeness thing of it. And my guess is that it didn't pass the smell test for you, because back then we were used to, like me, thinking that they would correct where they were wrong. Like, we were used to actual, what looked like journalism to us. Mm-hmm. And now the standards are so abysmally low that they don't even try to give evidence. You just say, well, are you Republican or a Democrat? Did Fox say or did CNN say it? And you have absolutely no expectation of, they don't even show you the pictures anymore. If you see some of these school shootings or whatever, there's nothing. There's no picture at all. It's like a little piece of tape and guy smoking cigarettes or whatever, you know, just like whatever, yada, yada.
Oh, they bulldozed the school afterwards, because that's normal.
Yes, I know. And it kept, as they went on, as these stories go on, they just have fewer and fewer details. So the Sandy Hook thing, they actually put a lot of effort into, and they got you to kind of have a template in your mind, the way I look at it anyway, that a template in your mind of how something like that would look. And then they just call that back for you in any place that it happened, San Antonio or this place or that place. Oh, it you know, ever since Etzhook, whatever, this is how it is. And you just never see the pictures. Do you know? I mean, can you even think of the layout in any of these kind of ever since then? They don't even bother with the mock-up, seems like.
Well, unless you go on Ellen. Ellen, after the Vegas shooting, then she has the mock-up for you and has to walk you through. Okay, so you were standing here.
Yeah, I walked the guy through. Yeah,
the guy's like, Jess. Yeah. Jess, whatever. You know, like nodding his head going, if you say so. Yeah, it's very fake. I would also remind people that this happened in 2013. These things all, the school shootings, the Boston bombings, all of these questionable events happened after Obama passed the Smith-Mundt Modernization Act of 2012, which legalized propaganda inside the United States. So all these things started happening after that. I'm not trying to say that there wasn't propaganda being used on us before that, but I am saying that they took that step to legalize it. And therefore, this is not a crime.
Yeah. And that actually matters, because they don't want to be the scapegoat. But the last, I mean, this is what my research came up with. Maybe I'm wrong, but I've verified it more than once. Michael Hastings' last article was on that Smith-Mundt amendment. Michael Hastings was the guy who died in a fiery crash. Mm-hmm. Everyone said, oh, well, he called out McChrystal or whatever. And maybe he did, just was drunk driving after a long spell of sobriety many years. I actually went and saw the tree. It was like totally, I just happened to be in LA at that time. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you were, but just to see the scenario, to see if it looked like a place that your car would literally blow up because you're going so fast. I mean, I couldn't make heads or tails of it, but that was the last thing he worked on.
Interesting. Yeah, I knew he had been working on the Stanley, obviously the Rolling Stone article on Stanley. Yeah. Crystal came out that, you know, did not do him any favors. I think he understood how that worked.
Well, they know that you're not going to lie. That's the problem. So I don't think he died for the McChrystal thing, but if there was something going, I always wonder about Anthony Bourdain. Like, I think he wouldn't lie. And I think there were problems with that Harvey Weinstein story.
Yeah.
Among other. Well,
what's funny is that, Michael Hastings' widow, was he married or was it just his girlfriend, whoever he was living with? I think he was married, but she is, you know, just an innocent person that had nothing to do with it. She's on the advisory board of NewsGuard, which has a bunch of CIA spies on it.
Since when?
Since Whitney Webb did the article on it.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
I'm not totally convinced that she's in the clear.
Right. Or that she's really his girlfriend.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, maybe not.
And also, I mean, there's one, either they come in from before or maybe they play the game after. A lot of people will not say, they'll say, oh, my guy definitely just had a heart attack right in front of me. Yeah. I don't know what you're talking about. You know, who's not going to say that? Everybody says that. I mean, well, Vince Foster's wife says that.
You just saw what happened to someone that went against them. So it's like, you either say this or, you know, maybe your car hits a tree on San Vicente at 100 miles an hour.
Yeah. That's why I think they do that. They send the message. And as a matter of fact, too, this is a story that is almost impossible to find. You can find it. You can't verify the names, but the FBI hostage team is very small. It's 80 or 90 people. They only do they're not usually on multiple cases, and they were called in for the Jahar Tsarnaev thing. Mm-hmm. And two of those guys, they were 40 and 41 years old. I mean, that is a prime agent right there. Two of them about a month later fell out of a helicopter during training to their deaths.
Wow.
Fell out of the helicopter. I mean, it was really crazy. And you could see in RT, I think it said that Russia Today, that they were connected to the Tsarnaev thing. I never could absolutely verify. Oh, yes, because the Sentinel down there, whatever the Sentinel was, it was in Virginia somewhere, the pilot, something like that, that newspaper, that journalist was trying to get to the bottom of it because the FOIA request was like 100% redacted. Mm-hmm. It was very fishy. And I think they do that to silence people, the guys who they throw out of helicopters, but mm-hmm. also the people who, the other 78 people who are like, yeah, I 100% legit.
Yeah. It's a dark world when you get into this. And so, you know, so my point of the Boston bombing, when people say, well, what do you think about the Boston bombing? What do you think happened? Well, what happened was it was a drill simulating a terrorist event at the Boston Marathon. Now, why do I think that? Well, let me tell you, there's a couple of reasons why I think that. The first is, and this is not, I'm not putting this in any sort of particular order, but just, there was a tweet from the Boston Globe, at Boston Globe, tweeted out before the bombing at 12:53 p.m. Breaking news, police will have controlled explosion on 600 block of Boylston Street. That's where the bombing happened. Tweet number two, also at 12:53, right afterwards, officials, : there will be a controlled explosion opposite the library within 1 minute as part of bomb squad activities. So, you know, that's something. Then there's videos that you can watch of the Boston bombing, that if you crank the volume up, you can hear over a loudspeaker that says, this is a drill. This is a drill. Now, that obviously doesn't get much play on the nightly news, but then there's a quote that I put in the book from Allie Stevenson, who is the University of Mobile cross-country coach. And this is what he said. At the start line this morning, they had bomb spotters on the roof of the buildings, and they had bomb-sniffing dogs coming up and down down at the start line. And Melanie, his wife, said they had bomb-sniffing dogs at the finish line, but they kept making announcements saying to the participants, do not worry, this is just a training exercise. And we were told on a loud announcement that we shouldn't be concerned. It was just a drill. So maybe it was just a drill, but I mean, I was there at the Athletes Village, and I did see a drill going on, and I did hear the announcements that it was just a drill. So this statement was given to, it was given on live television to local
people in Boston. I was going to say, how did they get that out? Well, yeah. I guess they wanted people not to panic and run away, and they wanted it to look legit. I don't know why they would do it that way. I don't know why they, why do you think they would do it that way? Because that's a common pattern, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, drills and simulations going live is a real, is a trick that they like because it allows them the ability to pre-position assets of people, equipment, fake bombs, real bombs, whatever. It allows them to position these without much suspicion, because if anyone ever says, hey, what's going on here, you say, well, we're just running a drill, and then these drills wind up going live.
Right.
So
yeah, that was in your book. I did read that. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right.
So
that's
the,
right,
so the plan of this drill was that terrorists would plant fake devices and then stay on the scene to monitor and record the bomb squad and detectives as they responded. But the insane twist was that the detectives would not know that they were part of a drill. So what they were saying is, we're running this drill with these fake terrorists, but the cops weren't going to be in on it. They were going to think it was real.
People killed.
Yeah. So as far as they knew, it was going to be an actual terrorist event. The goal of the training was for these detectives to figure out the motives of the Free American Citizens terrorist group, a non-existent group that they believe to be real. So as they investigated the case, they just went about it thinking this is a real thing. And so even a police spokesman said during the, discussing Urban Shield, which is the drill they were running, we can't talk about what we're doing for emergency preparedness. The people who participate in this don't know what the scenario is.
Dude, I mean, well, that probably makes sense for everybody, even the bystanders, to do it that way then for authenticity, I guess, although that seems like a dangerous game to play. But what you're saying about the right wing stuff, I remember Alex Jones reported that day that it was going to come out in a few days that it was this teenage right wing guy. Now, it was ended up being a teenage dental student, Jahar Tsarnaev, that they pinned it on. But I also have seen where they can do just different scenarios and see what plays. But there was one thing that was in your book, and also I remember it distinctly, is the Kraft guys were there.
Yes.
And Chris Kyle was killed just a month or two before that. And I always wondered if there might have been some connection, because the circumstances of his death were weird. And I'm wondering if they let him in on it and he didn't like it.
That's a possibility. I'd never considered that. But yeah, one of the things that the media kept saying in the aftermath of it is that a backpack was left with a pressure cooker. A black backpack was left with a pressure cooker. It blew up. It had nails in it. It killed all these people. It was really horrible. Anybody that has, you know, I don't know the extent to which the media was necessarily involved in it either, because, I mean, the police didn't know what was really going on, and maybe the media didn't know. I'm sure the reporters didn't have any idea, but maybe the people at the top did. But regardless, they ran this story when they said, we want everybody to send in, if you were there, if you have any pictures of, you know, just casual pictures that you took that have people with black backpacks, please send them in. Well, they had to tell everyone to stop, because so many people sent in pictures of the Kraft International guys that were sitting there with khaki pants, you know,
I've seen the pictures,
the black sweatshirts, the Kraft hats, and black backpacks. They were everywhere.
The hats with the logo.
With their logo on.
I mean, it was
the Punisher
crazy
logo. Despite what your mama told you, violence does solve problems. That's their motto. Isn't that nice?
That's so nuts. Yes. And the funny thing is that the pictures of the backpacks on the Tsarnaev brothers, the backpacks were clearly not
different.
Full of pressure cookers.
They show a picture of a backpack that exploded, which was the same type of backpack that all the Kraft guys were wearing. There's a picture of a Kraft guy, a specific Kraft guy, with a backpack on. There's a picture of him. Another picture of him, could have been before, probably was afterwards. He's running and he doesn't have the backpack on. Where'd your backpack go, bro?
And the picture of those guys with the backpacks had, in one of the pictures, a guy with an earpiece, you know, a curly earpiece, mm-hmm. in a niche as these guys walk by and are captured by the see this closed circuit TV or whatever it was that caught the picture of those guys with backpack. And I was really, I don't know if it was Mueller, I can't remember, but I thought, I think in retrospect, it must've been because it was the head of the FBI, unless it was a head of the regional one, asking people with that picture to help them identify these two guys. Mm-hmm. But those two guys, even though they were associated with the CIA, they were also on a terrorist watch list and listed as being 1 mile, living 1 mile away from that spot. So really, we have an FBI that can't find the terrorist. Like, you could have a map of terrorists, like Google map your terrorists, like realtor.com. And the closest terrorist to the event would have been those guys. Yeah. And they're like, whoa, who are these guys?
Well, the Department of Homeland Security has now officially acknowledged the, quote, frighteningly similar scenarios between Operation Urban Shield, the drill they planned for Boston, and the actual Boston Marathon event in a Boston Globe article. So they've admitted, boy, you know, we were running. Where have I seen that before?
Yeah, event 201 in COVID.
Event 201 in COVID. 7/7 bombing.
Similar. I predict the future with Event 201. It's like, oh. The stock market's going to go down 40%. And I remember a guy in the business like, you can't predict that with certain terms. Like, they said it would, and it did, and it did. And it was that day. I was like, wow, they are good.
Yeah, it's crazy that. So what it turns out is that if you know that there are drills running in, and I'm not trying to say that drills in and of themselves are a bad thing, because yeah, you practice, you want to make sure
you
get good at these things, and you know, you need to practice. So I get that. Professional athletes go to practice every other day, you know, so, but when the drills mimic an event, or when the drills happen and then an event happens that is almost identical to the drills, it is logical for you to assume that there might be some overlap there. Now, if you had a government that you really loved and trusted, like you had originally just believed that it couldn't possibly.
Oh, right. I was already disillusioned, but I couldn't get my, never. I would never suspect them.
That's a whole nother step besides nother my level. Government's corrupt, but to my government will pull false flags.
Well, at least they're Americans, yeah.
But so you're not really even, most of us are not even really willing to comprehend or even entertain the idea that this could be something that something like an actual false flag. In this particular case, I'm not as concerned. I mean, I'm obviously concerned,
but
I'm
not,
because I know that all those people that they said died and went to the hospital and the 27 different, that's all bullshit. That's 100% bullshit, because you can't blow up people with fake bombs. And if you watch the videos of these explosions, they're unlike any explosion you've ever seen. They go straight. It goes straight up in a huge. It's a stage explosion. It's stagecraft. And then you examine all the people that are down there rolling around, and you can watch videos of them cutting their clothes, and you can see other people that are spotters come in and pour fake blood out of backpacks. I mean, it is. They get a C- for this one. I'm really disappointed. Well, whoever was running this operation, I hope they got demoted, because it was such a slight, like they brought in the junior varsity team to pull this one off. I'm really, you know, after 9/11, I guess they figured they could do whatever they wanted and nobody would question it.
Yeah. They did a real one. Is that what you want? Like that's,
but we've got, but then, you know, every good story has to have a hero. And in this story, we got Carlos Arredondo, the hero with the cowboy hat. Do you remember him? How can we forget Carlos Arredondo, who bravely treated people, bravely put a tourniquet on Jeff Bauman's leg, incorrectly, by the way, then put him onto a wheelchair.
A wheelchair!
He shouldn't have, in which he would have bled out in 4 minutes.
Bleeding out your... Ugh.
And wheeled him. Now, I've got a quote here from, I want to read this one. This is from Robert David Steele, who, ironically, I just talked to a couple days ago. I didn't talk to him about this, but he had a quote, and I started off my chapter on it, and this is what it says. Boston bombing, for me, the truth teller was when the rabbis and the priests rushed to comfort the wounded, and they were not allowed to get near any of the wounded. That in intelligence we call an indicator. And then you add to that the fact that there were no, I mean no, wounded people taken to hospitals. And finally, you add to that the big to-do about the amputee. He turned out to be a hired actor for a company that specializes in putting amputees into battlefield simulations. False flag. Boston was a practice attempt to lock down an entire city.
Did they prove that with that guy? That guy, who he really was? I mean,
His last name is Voigt. He lost his legs in Afghanistan, and every time you saw him, his legs were amputated at a different spot. It was sloppy.
It was clear.
It was clear. It was clear. I mean, I made a joke in there. It's like, you know, you see him one place, and then he at like the Red Sox game or whatever, and he's got, you know, he's amputated by his knees. You see him at the Boston Bruins game where he dropped the puck. He's amputated even higher than that. And I was like, you better not go to a Celtics game or they'll cut your head off. You know what I mean? I mean, at the rate they're going, you'll have no legs, no arms, and no legs at that point. I mean, it was really quite embarrassing to me. But still. If we have this conversation with people that are sort of, you know, unaware of how these things play out, we run the risk of sounding like unhinged conspiracy theorists for pointing out.
When you start laughing at people who've had their legs blown off, like, it's not even funny that he had his, like, he was seriously injured in Afghanistan. Like, I'm sure he was trying to do the best thing for his country when he signed up. So that's not that. But like, even the ISIS beheading videos, like, I saw a real one once. It still makes me want to throw up. Like, it is so effed up. And then you see the ones of like, when they fake lit a cage on fire with a guy who was standing on an X, and there's this like mockery ISIS beheading video that's like fake. And I was laughing at that once. Somebody in my house walked by and they're just like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Sorry for cussing. You might want to bleep that. Okay. So what is wrong with you? Like, why would you laugh at that? Like, people are, and I'm like, well, I'm only laughing at it because there are so many fake ones. I'm laughing at the fake ones. The real ones are actually, the fake ones make a mockery of the real ones. The mockeries of the fake ones are not a problem. The fake ones, which divert attention from the real. See, that's the thing with the Boston Marathon bombing. Like, I still wasn't completely comfortable saying this is our government up to no good. Mm-hmm. And I would say I'm not trying to defend terrorists. I just want to know who the terrorists are.
Right.
Because like Tamerlan, he was arrested. I had a video on my site and I'm sure it's gone. There's only one or two left. I had uploaded a few, but I can't find any of it. And there was a video where the Watertown shootout, people don't realize that the closest you can get to the official story of that was there were six Watertown cops and nobody else, plus a Boston Transit cop, Donahue, who was also at the Collier shooting. Like, there was a really weird detail about that I don't think anybody picked up on, is that they said Donahue bled out in Watertown. He was the only cop who got hit because this video was Tamerlan Tsarnaev getting out of his car saying, "We give up. We didn't do it. We give up," before the shooting started. Then the shooting started. And then there was a point at which he was naked and arrested, and that was on tape. And I believe the Mercedes SUV was a cop, undercover cop in that car. I don't know what happened with the carjacking thing, but there was something weird about that SUV, which did run him over. But I don't think his little brother did it or any of that. But Donahue was supposedly there at Watertown, bled out completely, shot in the femoral artery. Like, somebody walked up to him and went, you know. Mm-hmm. And he was without blood for 45 minutes. I had to investigate this. That actually sounds crazy, but there are some places that can, in just the right circumstances, replenish all your blood. Like, maybe there's, I don't know, I don't want to get into it, but there have been cases where people have been resuscitated that way. And he was, I think he was left to die, and he was resuscitated. He can't remember anything about it, but I don't know what really happened with the MIT cop Collier who was killed. Mm-hmm. But this guy Donahue, I think he was with him. And that was like another crazy detail that went on there. But I think Tsarnaev was never killed anybody, never shot anybody. And basically was, I don't know if he was murdered by them, or maybe he tried to get away when he realized what that was in store for him. I don't know. But I wanted to see who killed whom. That's all. I'm not trying to defend terrorists. I'm just trying to figure out who's terrorizing whom and who's doing the killing and who's doing the dying.
Yeah, I just thought it was weird at the scene where, you know, where were all of the paramedics? There weren't paramedics.
Right. There. You were saying rabbis and priests. And I was thinking, I'm sure there were doctors around. They were med guys, you know, athletes.
Carlos Arredondo was the guy who was doing that. He was there to save the day. And, you know, I mean, is he a doctor? Like, is he an off-duty doctor? No, yeah. He's an actor or whatever.
And he didn't look like your typical kind of who goes to watch a marathon. People were interested. You know, I mean, he seemed like he was at a rodeo.
He did seem like he was at a rodeo. He was at a rodeo, essentially. Yeah. I mean, it's not. So it turned out that this Jeff Bauman guy is a dead ringer for a guy named Nick Vault, who had his legs blown off in Kandahar, Afghanistan, November of 2011 with the 1st Striker Brigade, 25th Infantry Division. So, you know, and there's a market for that. I know people kind of roll their eyes when you hear crisis actors. They're like, get the fuck out of here with these crisis actor things that you're talking about. Listen, they're real. It's a real business.
It's a real business. You can actually find it. It's an absolute real business. I've put up the websites before. They do it to train EMTs, if nothing else.
Yeah. Well,
you know, crisis response.
According to this, Jeff Bauman, the victim who lost both his legs, was adjacent to the location of one of the bombs. Upon recovering consciousness, he asked for a pen and paper and wrote a note to the FBI. Bag, saw the guy, looked right at me. Bauman was later able to provide detailed descriptions to the authorities of a suspect who was seen placing a backpack beside him at the bombing scene 2.5 minutes before it exploded, enabling the photo to be identified and circulated quickly, according to Wikipedia. So this guy, so the fake crisis actor told the FBI that the bomber looked him in the eyes before leaving his backpack beside him. Okay. Case closed. Yeah. Thank you. We got it now. The black backpack that everyone rightfully identified as belonging to the Kraft International, guys, which for people that don't know what Kraft International is, it's like Blackwater. It's a Blackwater. Yeah, it's a private mercenary military company. They do all kinds of things. One of the things they do is this. And when you work with DHS on Operation Urban Shield, one of the things that you see is that they bring in other agencies to help work with them to make everything as real as possible. It's undeniable that Kraft was there.
Yeah, the founder of Kraft was the American Sniper of the movie with Bradley Cooper. I mean, that guy was
the guy who Jesse Ventura rightly said is full of shit.
Oh, do you think so? Like, I would never watch that movie even because it's just the whole premise of the foreign wars is abhorrent to me. But I think he thought he had a moral compass, and I think that this wouldn't do. But what Jesse Ventura said he was full of shit.
Yeah, the guy got into it turned into a lawsuit.
Oh, really?
Yeah, against I don't know if they were suing. I think they were suing Jesse Ventura for something, and Jesse won because I can't remember if Jesse was suing him or if he was suing Jesse Ventura.
But well, he was probably suing Jesse Ventura because Jesse Ventura had that like conspiracy show or whatever he said. So he was saying a lot of bad stuff about people.
It wound up that it was really Jesse Ventura against Chris Kyle's widow, which is bad for optics. But it was because she was the executor of his estate or, you know, he wasn't going after her. But anyway, it turned out that Chris Kyle was lying and Jesse Ventura proved it. I mean,
And what a strange way that he died. I mean, why would you take a guy with PTSD to a shooting range? You know, that's what happened to him. Yeah. Well, who knows? I bet that's a rabbit hole, but I just, after I investigated this one and a couple of others, MH370, Miriam Carey, there were a few. Miriam Carey was that chick who was absolutely gunned down by the Capitol Police, just murdered. Remember, they took the baby out of the car and they just riddled her with bullets.
I don't even remember that one.
Yeah, she had, I think the real actual official story was that she was a dental hygienist at a dentist when Obama had an emergency toothache in Connecticut. Okay. And I mean, I've heard stories that Obama's gay, so I don't know if this is true or not, but there was a speculation that her baby was Obama's. and that she was going down there. She was causing trouble and they wanted to get rid of her. So they said, oh, he wants to see you. So she went and tried to get into the White House and they wouldn't let her in. And then they started chasing her and trying to get her. And she was just trying to get away. And they cornered her, grabbed the baby out of the car and shot her 13 times. And she's dead. So that was one thing. It was a crazy story. And then they got in hazmat uniforms and completely sanitized her apartment that night. They went up to Connecticut and sanitized. And I thought the only thing it could have been was the DNA. And no one ever saw the baby again. Really crazy.
Whoa.
And there was a lawyer. Nuts. Yeah, there was a lawyer for the family who was starting to sue for her after she was dead. And they put him in jail and they upped his fine $1,000 a day until he paid some big back payment he had for a bankruptcy judgment or whatever. And then when he got out, he actually emailed me too. Like, I don't know what was happening during this little brief period of time. People were trying to reach out to me probably because I had a radio show and they knew I would say anything or let anybody say anything.
And but, you don't have a radio show anymore.
No, I don't. I think
and
that
why
was,
is that?
I had it for 8.5 years and I would talk about all this stuff. And even Parkland, I actually got dinged from YouTube. I got a strike. You get 3 strikes and you lose your channel. So I just stopped posting there because I don't want to lose like my subscribers or whatever. Right. But I stopped because I posted a WSB show on my YouTube channel and YouTube took it down for bullying Sheriff Israel in the Parkland case. And this was like a week before everybody decided to hate him, but this was when he was still supposedly a hero. Mm-hmm. And still I didn't get taken down from WSB, but when in February 8th of this year, when the first Corona case came down, I was like, oh my gosh, I know this one. This is Event 201. So I started playing clips of their show. Like they had fake news stories in the Event 201 thing, which predicted the novel coronavirus, which is Johns Hopkins, Bill Gates, and the World Economic Forum and the World Health Organization was there, CDC, everybody who's saying stuff about this now was in on this original thing. And I was literally predicting the future. And I was playing these news clips and I started getting nervous because they sounded so realistic. I thought it was going to be like a War of the Worlds thing where people in their car was going to be like 65 million people are dead.
Right.
That was the only detail that did not come true. Thank God. But
it's not over yet. They still said 18 months. Know.
And Gates said Phase 2 will really get people's attention. So by February 28th, so Cox Media had owned WSB for all that time. And my program director loved like Art Bell. He was a radio guy. He loved good radio. And he was like, you're good radio. So he loved me. And then the company got bought by Apollo, who is run by a friend of Jeffrey Epstein's. He's actually going to have to go testify in the Virgin Islands about having Epstein as the head of his foundation at one point. But that guy bought the station I worked for. And then my boss retired. And then on his last day, he was like, sorry, honey, it's your last day too. So, but other people at the station thought I quit. Like there was no good I don't think it was plausible that they just thought I wasn't radio worthy. I don't know. Yeah, maybe they did.
Long enough. No, it couldn't have been that. It had to be the topics that you were taught.
But the CDC of all things is in Atlanta, which is where my show was. Mm-hmm. And that was the only time I ever got like a lot of hate mail. The other thing was when somebody called and I entertained a lengthy conversation with him and other callers who were rallying around the premiere of Vaxxed, which was Del Bigtree's documentary, I think in 2016, it was aired like at a theater and I gave people the platform to talk about it. I didn't know anything about it. It wasn't one of my issues at all, but that was the only other time that my boss said, wow, man, people are mad at you.
Yeah.
And I was like, I didn't even know.
Were you on the Union of the Unwanted with us a couple weeks ago when Dell was there?
Yes. And I told him that story because it was the only time like that. I would talk about everything. The Boston Marathon bombing, MH370. I talked about everything. I didn't talk about 9/11 except for my last show before they took me off the air. I didn't know before I knew. So like it is possible that I just fired all my guns at once because I got a new executive producer and he said, oh, your podcast is awesome. Like do exactly that on the radio. And I was like, really? I'm not sure. That's a great idea. And he's like, no, no, it's gold. It's radio gold. You're going to break new ground. So I was like, okay. So I got on. I was like, geez, anybody who doesn't know about 9/11 is kidding themselves. Get your head out your butt, you know, right. And stuff like that. And then that was it. I just let my hair down or just let my guard down.
Yeah.
And then it was all over. But maybe I just sucked all of a sudden. I don't know.
No, I don't think it's that.
I don't know.
So I saw Vaxxed in the theater. I was telling Del this, that it's the only time I came out of a movie theater and all the media trucks were lined up there and they were interviewing people that were coming. I didn't talk to the media.
Where were you?
In
LA?
Denver. In Denver. Yeah. And it was in an obscure theater, like an older, you know, like a funky
indie
vintage
stuff, yeah.
Theater, which is, you know, probably the only place that would show it. And, you know, I know about his problems in Australia, getting thrown out of there. David Icke and I were chatting in Mexico at an Acapulco. And he was like, well, I'm going to Australia in a couple of days. I was like, well, I hope you don't get the Del Big Tree treatment. And he couldn't even get on the plane to go there. They've revoked his visa hours before the flight. So Australia is pretty authoritarian, as we're seeing now when it comes to medical or, you know, people talking about, you know, non-traditional things. They have a big problem with that. They threw Del and everybody out of Australia for that. And so, you know, you might... If they're kicking you off the radio, if they're throwing you out of a country, a full continent like Australia, it's not because if you don't have a criminal record, you know, and it's not because you're a dangerous criminal. It's because the things that you're talking about are dangerous to the establishment. And whether it be Boston bombing or the CDC, if I had been in your shoes on a radio show in Atlanta, I would have been thrown off way before you because
I tried not to get thrown off.
I'm so hard against the CDC and described them.
People work there.
Yeah.
Like that was their job. So everybody listening was ready to narc on me on that stuff.
Mm.
So I didn't know that was going to do it. And I just tried not to offend people or say things that weren't true. Like that's what I thought would get you thrown off. I didn't realize saying things that were true is what got you thrown off.
Yeah. Oh, no, you would understand inherently that if you're making up things about them, that it could come back to haunt you. You know, if you're making up lies and just
they could sue you.
Yeah, they could sue you. But that actually won't necessarily get you thrown off. They'll just paint you as a crazy person. It's when you're telling the truth. That's when you really have to worry.
I think they like it when you're crazy and lying and stuff because they can debunk it. They want you there if you do that. But like with the event 201 stuff, it wasn't crazy. It was there in their own words. I mean, you couldn't have, I thought I was rock solid there. I didn't say anything I was just playing their clips. That's the kind of thing I would do. I would just play the clips.
Yep. That's the thing that has always made me insane. When I'll have a debate, you know, a discussion or it turns into a debate or whatever about some particular topic and, you know, and I'm coming at it from some alternative angle that they haven't heard of yet. I'm always trying to tell them, listen, this isn't me saying these things. This is them saying these things. Here's a list of all, you know, I'm using their own words against them. I described it as verbal judo, where I use their own words against them.
To
get my point across. It's like, now I could come out and say whatever I want, make up some crazy things or go be over the top aggressive, go full Alex Jones, you know, and rant and rave, which I've done, of course, but it's so much more effective when you just use their own words or their own documents. It's like the CDC, I don't have to make up anything about them. They're doing a really good job of providing me with enough information to hang them.
And in the event 201, it said how they were going to suppress information that made it hard for them to implement their policies. It was crazy. And then if you go to the 2010 Rockefeller Foundation one called Lockstep, they talk about slowing down the internet and preventing it from crossing borders. I mean, that's a different scenario from what I had always been operating. There were two big assumptions I always operated under, which are, I didn't realize they were mutable, but they are mutable. One is that it was going to be amorphic world government. Like, it was going to be crystal clear. Everybody was under a world government. Mm-hmm. And the other thing was that war with Iran was a real possibility. Now, I think Soleimani was a real Iranian loyalist, and we assassinated him for the Rouhani regime. Like, I think that now we need a great Satan. They need a great Satan. It's working. And this guy was actually going to blow that up. Not that he's my hero, but I think right. he was a real hero. So the Iran thing blows up for me. And then I realize now that there are, or I think that there are different scenarios. So you could have had Ted Cruz win, or Trump, or Hillary, depending on how people were feeling. And then you would just use whoever it was. They got lucky, I think, to get Trump, because they could really galvanize people with that. He's so entertaining, and he can get people off the couch, whether he's real or not. Like, he's working for this drama, which they're implementing. But the Rockefeller Foundation thing about lockstep opened my eyes to a different possible scenario, at least in the short run, which is the idea that you just, and it was in Event 201 de facto, if not like they were saying, this is how you do it, get all the presidents, all the political heads, and you get your rich oligarchs, whatever, to call them and tell them what to do, so that you look like you're splintering. But if everybody, so like with Trump versus the governors or whatever, it's like, oh my gosh, we have this splintered system. Mm-hmm. It's okay with them to splinter, as long as you get people to go in lockstep, and maybe they like that better because it makes us feel like we have local control, even though we really don't, I think, yeah. obviously. So I just, I got some, I really learned a few things in this latest event, but you know, I don't know how to use the information. I don't know what the plan is.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do with it.
It's a bit like putting a puzzle together where we've got all the corner pieces figured out. Yeah. We're working on everything in the middle. With every piece you put together, it makes the picture come, you know, look a little bit clearer. But we're still missing some pieces. They're still working on it. I mean, I have obviously been critical of this one world government push, but I also at the same time have to respect the fact that they are, that these psychopaths are committed to a very long term strategy, multi-generational, absolutely. That it doesn't necessarily absolutely. Have to get all figured out during George H.W. Bush's life. He knows he's going to die. He's been talking about the New World Order 200 times during his 4 years that he was in office, but they're so committed to it that they'll do whatever they can because they know that it might take the next generation or even the generation after them to fully put this all in place. And as David Icke says, he describes it as the totalitarian tiptoe, where you don't go from A to Z, you go from A to B, B to C, C to D, make these incremental changes. The people don't pick up on them as fast, and if you do it slowly, they wind up getting more established and ingrained, so they're almost impossible to roll out. And we see that with Patriot Act, take your shoes off before you get on a plane, you throw away your bottled water. You're like, oh, this is temporary. Well, we're still doing it. Oh, these masks, you wear the mask, it's temporary. Really? Are we going to have this conversation 20 years from now saying, you know, they told us the masks were temporary as I'm taking my shoes off still?
And people will do it voluntarily. Do you remember seeing, I remember seeing Chinese people a lot wearing masks, and it was because ever since that swine flu thing, which was focused in China, if you recall, mm-hmm. they would come over here, and it was just some people just always wore a mask when they were out. And I remember wondering if they, you know, what they had, but it wasn't what they had, is what they were afraid of getting. It was cultural. It was ingrained in their minds. And we're going to have people like that too.
For sure. And I've been to Hong Kong a couple times and Shanghai, and you'll see periodically people wearing masks, but I always chalk that up to more like pollution, you know, like I'm trying to keep the pollution.
But when they do it over here, it's in their minds. I'm not criticizing them. I'm just saying it has gotten into their minds. You don't have to make a law.
Yeah.
Is what I'm saying. People will bring it. But I observed that intergenerational thing firsthand. Like I discovered it for myself because I ended up in Ivy League schools, even though I'm the youngest of nine. My dad was a truck driver. I dropped out of high school. I went to community college, and I just landed up. I got a scholarship to Harvard, and then I ended up at Stanford and a JD MBA program. I'm not telling you this because I'm bragging. I'm telling you this because what I observed, it was a big struggle for me. I mean, I did not know how to dress. I didn't know how to comb my hair. I was taught super Catholic. So I was taught like to not wear makeup and stuff. Like it was vanity. I had absolutely no idea. And I was super moral. Like I still try to be moral, but like to me, I couldn't, it was like the journalist was like, oh, you got that wrong. You know, it's like, right, oh my gosh, like, you know, oh, I wouldn't lie because that would be wrong. You know,
you're a good person.
I was just, well, that's how I was trained. And I really was not exposed. I mean, my family was riddled with problems and drug addicts and everything, but there were things that we wouldn't do, like lie and steal. Right. Well, the druggies, you know, everybody steals eventually, but that was when they turned into different people. But what I observed around me was, first of all, anyone whose dad was an investment banker or something like that, they all kind of knew how to interview. They knew what banks to apply to. They could apply to their friend's dad's job and it wouldn't look like nepotism. You just swap jobs. But then you had like the higher level people whose names I recognized from the heads of corporations or from newspaper articles, from, you know, there were people in my class who were invited into the cabinet. One of the teachers, but it might as well have been one of the kids, was invited onto the Supreme Court. Another guy was just a big corporate. He might as well have been Ford, just a big corporation. I was like, wow, that's named after people. Like, you're that person, you know? So then I realized, and that guy knew what job to get out of school. Like, he knew what was coming. And I remember thinking, oh, I get it. You don't just get to tap into the American dream big time. And some people can do it, but the more and more you get like the government connected rich as the only way to get ahead, the more it shuts down and they can keep that super upper echelon where not only do they have those guys under lock and key because they have dirt on them or whatever, but if they come from those families, the way I was indoctrinated as a Catholic, they're indoctrinated as deep staters, and you can count on them. Every once in a while, you got to kill them, but mostly, so that's what, like, your octopus is mature.
Yeah. And there's a quote I put in the octopus book talking about the great octopus that with its slimy tentacles infecting every aspect of government and media and the judicial system and all this. And the quote, after you go three paragraphs down, it was by a guy named John Francis Hyland, who was the mayor of New York City. This quote was from 1922, and he was talking about this octopus. He was talking about specifically the Rockefeller octopus. And I was reading this going, holy shit, you know, it's been a century. Nothing's changed. It's still the same game. You know, it's still the same thing. Like you mentioned how these families that go to great colleges have an unfair advantage. If you're a member of Skull and Bones, I think a lot of people know about John Kerry and Bushes and all those guys. But one thing that most people don't realize is that if you're a member of Skull and Bones, when you graduate from school, when you graduate from Yale and you go off and start, you know, your career, you are gifted $250,000 from the Skull and Bone Society.
No way.
To help you get yourself started.
And then you get a job. If you're up against anybody else, you will get the job from the Bonesman. But for sure. Mrs. Tamerlan Tsarnaev, her grandpa was in Skull and Bones.
Oh, okay.
I feel like Catherine Russell. And actually, Skull and Bones is legally called the Russell Trust. I could not trace her to the foundation of it, but her grandpa was a CIA guy, and I think that's really how they got hooked up.
Oh my God.
I know.
Full circle all the way back. Ooga booga. That's Monica Perez. She does the propaganda report. You guys got to check that out. If you're not listening to it, what the hell is wrong with you? Monica, where can people find you? Where can people get your work and see your stuff?
My website's thepropreport.com, but we do a daily show called the Drive Time News Blast, my co-host Brad Binkley and I, where we do the news of the day from a perspective of truth, liberty, and justice. So you can get that on any podcasting platform under the Propaganda Report feed.
Awesome. Thanks, Monica. Hey, thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
If you like this episode, please share it, because you know the algorithms won't do that for us. Thanks so much, everybody.